In the near future, corporate networks reach out to the stars. Electrons and light flow throughout the universe. The advance of computerization, however, has not yet wiped out nations and ethnic groups. Greetings, cybernetic life forms, rogue AIs, and disembodied philosophical musings. Welcome to the Silver Screen Podcast. I am your host, Major Michael Wilson, and today we're jacking into the net to discuss one of the most iconic and influential anime films of all time, 1995's Ghost in the Shell. That's right, we're going full thermoptic camo for this one, but don't worry, unlike Major Kusanagi, we'll try to keep our existential crises clothed. Mostly. So now I am usually joined, as you probably know, by my trusty co-host DK, but he's currently off on a top secret Section 9 mission, probably just watching another kaiju flick, but we'll pretend it's espionage. And instead, I have a fantastic lineup of guests to break down this cyberpunk classic with me. Returning to the show, we have our very own cybernetic philosopher and drag race superfan, Toby. Yeah, as I say, you know, philosophical musings about cyber nature and drag race. Those are your two areas of expertise, I guess.
I'm just thinking Toby never realized that about himself. He's like, yeah, that's exactly what I am.
Oh, he knows. He totally knows.
And, I'm more history than philosophy, honestly. I'm just doing philosophy because I have to.
That makes sense. Well, we've got lots to talk about, philosophically speaking, when it comes to Ghost in the Shell and everything it deals with. But again, we'll get there. And you just heard her. We've also been joined by our tactical field expert, Sandy. Welcome.
Hello.
Yes, awesome. Welcome, Sandy and Toby. And you've both been on before, so no pressure, but just know that the Puppet Master is already analysing your every word. So, before we dive in, I do want to give a quick shout out to our friend Gavin, who desperately wanted to be on this episode, but he just couldn't make the timing work. However, he did make sure that we know that Ghost in the Shell is one of his absolute favorite films, so we'll try not to disappoint you, Gav. Right, let's kick things off the way we always do, by rewinding back to the first time we experienced this film. So I'll start with you, Toby. When did you first plug into the world of Ghost in the Shell, and do you remember your initial thoughts?
Okay. Yesterday at 3 a.m.
Oh, wow.
Because I totally forgot about this recording, and I was like going to sleep at 3 a.m. and I was like, oh, I haven't watched.
Wow.
So I was like, okay, it's only 83 minutes. So I was like,
yeah.
I'm going to sleep another hour late. It seems.
The perfect time to take in deep philosophical musings in a different language, 3 in the morning. Why not?
I rewind it so often.
Wow. Okay, so that was the first time that you actually had seen it then, yeah?
Yeah. Not
okay,
cool. I watched the TV series 17 episodes of it before I watched this movie.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah, you were saying off air you'd been watching, is it Standalone Complex, the TV show?
Yeah. It's good.
Awesome. And what did you make of that? You've enjoyed it, yeah?
It's really good.
Awesome.
There are some standalone episodes that are really, really good and really, really deep. And yeah,
awesome. That's good. I haven't watched any of it myself, but I've heard very good things. And just finding the time when it comes to big, long anime series and things too.
I mean, it's 52 episodes. It's not that long.
I guess, but you know, I love the movie, and I don't know. I'm worried it would sully the memory a little bit about the movie. Spoiler alert! But no, I mean, I'll be giving it a try someday.
Honestly, I think the series is better, in my opinion.
Really? Okay. Wow.
I do.
Fair enough.
But I think the main reason is that they're kind of doing different things, and I like the one.
Ah.
The series is doing more. Not different things, different approaches. Let's just say that. I'm going to get more into it later.
Okay, I see what you mean. Right, that's fair enough. And what about you, Sandy? Have you seen this before, or was it also a very last-minute thing for you?
The first two or three times I watched the film was yesterday.
What?
And then the fourth time was this morning. So
you watched it four times since yesterday?
What?
Yes. Well, like Toby, there was a lot of rewinding, a lot of huh-ing, and I feel like I finally have a really good grasp on the course of events now.
Okay, I just gave up at some point. You know? It's like,
oh, well, and one time I fell asleep.
Honestly, fair.
These are not glowing recommendations for this movie that I love.
It's a slow movie. If you're tired, you're going to fall asleep. So you better
the very first time I saw this movie, I was probably a bit too young for it, and it just went completely over my head. And I found it, if I'm honest, the very first time I think I thought it was a bit boring, but that was because I just didn't understand what it was saying and I didn't care, and I hadn't really watched any anime or any kind of foreign language films. And it was back in like middle school. We were doing it as part of a media studies class, so I think I just zoned out and was like, well, that was boring, and wasn't listening to all the reasons why it was actually really good. Then it came up again during my university studies for film studies, when we were dealing with actual, like, the most influential anime movies. And then from that, I was able to analyze the kind of importance and actually paid attention to what it was saying. And as I said last week, because I knew it was coming up, I did watch my 4K copy, take a drink, everyone, of Ghost in the Shell to give it another go. And I really enjoyed it, not just because it looks great, but because I don't know if it's because, like I said to you off air, I watched it dubbed in English, so I wasn't having to kind of read subtitles and keep up. And I don't know if that like reinforced a lot of the metaphor and a lot of the kind of deep quotes and philosophy a little bit better into my head. Because, you know, I try to pretend I'm intelligent, but a whole other language... You know, it's easier to understand things in English sometimes. Going back to what you were saying, Sandy, so you've only seen this recently, but you have seen it like four times. And you were saying off air that you think the version that you watched was 2.0, the kind of updated version of it.
The second time I watched, or the second and fourth, maybe. I watched it a couple of times just to...
So you've watched both versions. That's steady. Yes. Yeah, fair enough. I've never seen the 2.0 version, but as I was saying off air, I've heard there's only kind of minor differences in some of the animation and the color grading and stuff. It's the same, you know, film basically overall. So yeah, I've only seen the 95 version, but so that's the one I'm going to be reviewing. But I'm interested to know if anything comes up and you're like, oh, it didn't happen, I can't remember that. But I don't think it will be the case, but it'll be interesting to see.
It won't, so, like you mentioned, it's just some design choices, a few design choices that were different, and a few parts that don't look at all like animation, but otherwise.
Same. Well, with the advances in animation over the whatever it was, a couple of decades or so, it's understandable, I suppose. So, yeah, okay. I'm going to jump in then to a behind the scenes section on Ghost in the Shell. Again, hopefully it won't be too dry, but feel free, guys, to jump in with any questions or thoughts or whatever. Just interrupt me if you want to, and I'll try to get through it. So I'll start by saying that Ghost in the Shell is a 1995 Japanese animated tech noir cyberpunk action thriller. Enough genres? Yeah, yes, indeed. The film is based on the 1989 to 1990 manga of the same name by Masamune Shirow, and I apologize in advance for probably butchering a lot of these names. It was a Japanese-British international co-production between Kodansha, Bandai Visual, and Manga Entertainment, with animation provided by Production IG, that being the film. The film is set in 2029 in the fictional Newport City and follows Major Motoko Kusanagi, a cyborg public security agent who hunts an enigmatic hacker or ghost known as the Puppet Master. The narrative incorporates philosophical themes that focus on self and identity in a technologically advanced world. Upon release, Ghost in the Shell received positive reviews, with critics praising its narrative, visuals, and musical score. The film was initially considered a box office failure before developing a cult following on home video. Since then, it has grown in esteem and is now considered to be one of the greatest anime and science fiction films of all time. It has inspired filmmakers such as the Wachowskis, creators of the Matrix franchise, and James Cameron, who described it as the first truly adult animation film to reach a level of literary and visual excellence. At the 24th Annie Awards in 1996, the film received numerous accolades and was nominated in 5 categories, including Best Animated Feature, giving it the most nominations for a Japanese animated film at the Annie Awards until both The Boy and the Heron and Suzume took over the position with 7 at the 51st Annie Awards in 2024. So yeah, took a while. An updated remastered version of the film, Ghost in the Shell 2.0, as we said, was released in 2008, featuring newly added digital effects, additional 3D animation, and new audio. Oshii also directed Ghost in the Shell 2 Innocence, released in 2004, which was billed as a separate work and a non-canonical sequel. Hollywood made a live-action reinterpretation of the original film in 2017, bearing an identical title, directed by Rupert Sanders and starring Scarlett Johansson. But the less said about that, the better. Ghost in the Shell has been released in multiple versions on VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. The version I watched and will be reviewing, as I said, is from the most recent 4K release of the film. So if you're curious, that was the version I was looking at, and that you can find for yourself if you want to. So, anything there... shock anyone or anything you wanted to comment on before I move us along?
Yeah, I do have some comments. First of all, I wasn't aware that it was Production IG that made this, which is interesting. Because they also
Is that something you're familiar with, yeah?
Yeah, it's a pretty well-known studio, actually.
Okay, cool.
And they did Psychopaths a few years ago, which also very cyberpunk and also really, really deep and not that philosophical, but more like deep in the sense that it's just showing various problems with future and it's all, mass surveillance and crime prevention and all that.
Yeah,
how far you can go, how far it's okay.
Because Ghost in the Shell, I think it does deal in part with kind of the blurred lines between human and technology, but it kind of almost forgets that and involves itself more in the search for like identity and meaning just in general. So it's good that it does, you know, have these various areas, but it doesn't, for me, I think, delve quite as much into what, you know, what can technology do for us and what does it mean to be these cyborg creatures. But then again, I haven't seen the Ghost in the Shell sequel of the TV show, which I'm guessing dives a lot into that. So
the TV show does go a lot into more direct examples and ideas, and which is why I like it more.
Yeah, okay. I'll move us on to the section on the writing and the plot, which is obviously quite a hefty bulk of Ghost in the Shell. I'll just start with a few bits of information, first of all. The screenplay is by Kasunori Ito, and the film explores, as I said, the nature of human cyborgs, consciousness, self-aware computer programs, and memory alteration. In one of the monologues delivered by the puppet master in the film, it's argued that human DNA is nothing more than a program designed to self-preserve. There are also multiple mentions of the act of granting political asylum to self-aware computer programs, implying that they have some kind of sentience or some kind of agency to them. So before I carry on to the next part, I was going to kind of open the floor to that to discuss. Did you guys pick up on these particular themes, and did you have something that hit you? Or was that kind of one of the things that went over your head when you're trying to watch it 3 in the morning kind of thing?
Well, I think if I had watched this earlier in my 20s, it probably would have, these themes probably would have hit me a bit more. But I've, you know, consumed a lot of media where some of these ideas have been explored, and I was like an early student of philosophy, so these things definitely didn't hit me as hard as I think they would have if I had, you know, watched this in my younger years. However, thinking about, you know, how we were dealing with these ideas in the 90s and how, you know, like just beginning to kind of get the world connected to where this future was looking more and more possible, like Terminator and Matrix, you know, the machines taking over, AI becoming sentient, and, you know, exploring all those ideas separate from the philosophical ideas of where does the soul, you know, reside and that type of thing. You know, it is very poignant for, you know, what westernized thinking of is essentially a cartoon. So that's, you know, just, you know, it's very forward thinking for this medium. Although I do understand anime and manga have explored these ideas, you know, for a very long time and have been deep and philosophical. Yeah, it was just really, really interesting and deep and unexpected, I think.
Yeah, I mean, to your point though, it's always kind of not confused me, but it's kind of hard to bear in mind that the Puppet Master makes a great pains to point out that he's not AI, he's not artificial intelligence, he's just kind of, I don't even know how you'd describe it, like a program that came into some kind of self-awareness and now is alive. And the whole question is, well, has he then generated his own soul out of somewhere? Is he a sentient being? Is he alive? And putting aside the kind of, in terms of the political side of things, but putting aside for a second the kind of the cyborg people who are like, you know, like the Major, who it's like, okay, you're robotic, but you have a human brain. The Puppet Master is entirely, like you said, what we would probably call artificial intelligence, somewhat wrongly. But then the question becomes, you know, as I said, I really love these questions when they come up in sci-fi. And I love here when he questions, well, how can you possibly define when I'm alive when, you know, science, philosophy and religion cannot define what life is? Like, you can't prove to me you're alive, but in any real kind of sense. So how would you apply those criteria to me? And I'd love when it delves into kind of questions like that, especially when it's to do with machine technology. I mean, my dissertation at university was, it was called From Metropolis to the Matrix, and it was about representation of machine tech in sci-fi cinema. So that was a huge part of it, was that. And I love all that. I mean, I'm a huge, obviously, Star Trek fan, which goes into quite a bit of that with, you know, Data, among other things. And yeah, even like TV shows like Humans that came out a few years ago that delved into that, which was, you know, robots that were built to be slaves that then developed their own kind of sentience. And then it was about, do they have rights? And yeah, it's a lot to go into, and it's a lot to take, especially, as I said, when you're watching it early in the morning. So Toby, that's where I come over to you and ask, did you pick up on any of this? Did it make you think of anything, or was this a question of it's too much for me?
No, the problem wasn't the time. It was early in the morning. That wasn't the problem. I think, and that's your style of how you consume things, but I mean, it's very deliberate, but I think a problem is that they really don't take a lot of time to connect with the Puppet Master, and so that develop a character. They just kind of dive into these topics and are more talking about them than really showing them. And for me personally, I can get more understanding and more emotion out of it when it's done differently, when it's more shown than really just talking about. That's why I didn't really connect that much with the Puppet Master, but I did connect more earlier in the movie with the guy that had his memories replaced. That had more of a connection to me, more an emotional connection to me, because we not only heard about it, but we were really shown the effects of it, how he reacted, how others reacted, and all that.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I enjoy it, like I said, but I think it took 3 attempts, and it was only when I watched it in my own language that I was like, I get what you're saying with the Puppet Master. But it's a fair criticism that, like you said, all it is long speeches to the people that he's either, you know, being interrogated by or that he's being captured by. And you kind of really have to stop and take it in. And it does. It's very dry. Like you said, it's just, it's what's the word I'm looking for? It's kind of just proletarizing or whatever you call it, just to, you know, philosophizing to nobody in particular. And we have to, I love it when you can understand what's being said, but it does take until the end of the movie as well. It's only really the last 20, 30 minutes when you see the Puppet Master in any of his forms. Where are we? I'm going to move to the next bit. I'll tell you that the film depicts Motoko's concerns about identity and ends with the evolution of the Puppet Master, who is a being without reproduction. The critic Austin Corbett characterized the lack of sexualization from her team as freedom from freedom from femininity, noting that Motoko is overtly feminine and clearly non-female. In describing Motoko as a shapely and strong female protagonist at the center of the story, who is also nevertheless almost continuously nude, Carl Silvio has called Ghost in the Shell a resistant film due to its inversion of traditional gender roles, its valorization of the post-gendered subject, and its de-emphasis of the sexual specificity of the material body. So, yeah. Jumping over to deal with kind of Major Motoko Kusanagi herself, and then we'll get into that, you know, what happens with her and the Puppet Master at the end. First of all, did you pick up on this kind of, personally, I kind of did see it, that she's kind of desexualized, even as they kind of emphasize her female body. It's never really, it's not hypersexual, and it's not played for gratuitous, I guess, male gaze or whatever you would call it. The equivalent would be in animation. And yeah, she just seems very almost androgynous, almost doll-like. And I wondered if you guys thought anything similar, because I wondered if that was to do with like identity and kind of, you know, as part of that, is it, you know, your gender identity, and she's kind of not really got one because she's, it's not her body or whatever else, so she's struggling to understand it. So Sandy,
I did pick up on that, especially after she was diving and she just started pretty much anytime. She just took her clothes off like it was nothing, with no embarrassment or modesty or anything. And I did pick up on that. And I think it was easier to understand my second or third time around, you know, once you understood her nature. And that it was basically just a shell. It's making the argument, you know, for that separation.
Yes, absolutely. Because it isn't her. I mean, it's her brain, but it's a brain that's inside effectively a big robot. So why would you feel churlish about showing it to people? Because it's not you. And like I said, that kind of, it really reinforces in a visual way that separation of identity from the physical to the mental. Was that something that you picked up on, Toby, or was this just again, did you kind of notice maybe that there was something weird and they were doing something with this whole being naked all the time situation?
I mean, not really with the nakedness, and that's just me being desensitized from it, from animation.
Right. Right, fair enough. Yeah.
So I just instinctively just go, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
So not in that sense, but definitely in the way she acted outside of just removing her clothes.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like you said, even a lot of her actions kind of come off almost, for want of a better word, almost masculine coded, you know, the way that she attacks and uses her guns and everything. There's not really any differentiation between her and Batu as the kind of operatives. And nobody ever really, as far as I could tell anyway, comments on the fact that she's a woman or makes her feel other because of that or in any way different.
And the other thing that's male coded, but not necessarily true, was her lack of emotion, really.
Yes. Yes. As I said, because again, that deals with the identity of like, well, at what point, you know, if we're looking into what makes a soul, has she sold hers in favor of this, you know, cybernetic body? Is she now soulless, but has the brain that, you know, has the memories and whatever else? And as Toby said, dealing into like, well, if you erase your memories, is that taking away your soul? Where does this spark of life reside? And at what point when you're mucking around with these things, do you lose it or gain it? So like I said, I like these thing kind of philosophical questions, and I like that they don't always provide just nice, easy answers when they're being explored. And I can see why, like you said, this was called one of the first adult animated movies, because, like you said, in what would be considered a children's medium still in a lot of places, you know, it's dealing with heavy themes and ideas and never really giving you much of an answer, which again, I think might be why when I first saw it when I was only about 14, I was like, it's boring. I don't, you know, I like the bits where they're shooting guns and that's about it, because I just didn't get what it was trying to do. So, yeah, but I can also see why it's influenced so many kind of sci-fi and cyberpunk things as well. I mean, you can 100% see the DNA of, for example, the Matrix in this. So, yeah. Well, at least I could anyway. Did you guys pick up on anything? That's just an interesting question to ask. Did you see anything of like what would become future kind of cyberpunk and sci-fi cinema? Yeah.
I mean, individual things, yes, but not like a specific reference. I'm like, oh, this leads to that directly, but like general things and themes and
green lettering was very Matrixy in the beginning, and just the cables hooking up to the back of her neck, again, another almost direct Matrix reference. And then, yeah, just the themes, we do see that get picked up a lot through different movies and things that followed.
Definitely. And I mean, the Wachowskis were interviewed and I think once said, no Ghost in the Shell, no Matrix. It's as simple as that. It was one of the biggest influences. And if you look at the Puppet Master, he is basically the agents from the Matrix, which is perhaps a way to put it in terms that more pop culture savvy people would understand that didn't necessarily want to understand this movie or could struggle to understand it. It's the same kind of idea that this was kind of a computer program that then became sentient and self-aware and wanted its own agency outside of the system. And it's all basically the same idea, you know, along with, like you said, the melding of man and machine, which becomes a whole thing, which, I mean, that's not even exclusive to Ghost in the Shell. That's been a thing going back even to, I mean, probably even further, but certainly things like RoboCop with the kind of body horror and the melding of, like I said, flesh and technology.
Batu's cybernetic eyes remind me of Cypher and his little glasses.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember liking the visual of that every time I've seen this, because something about the visual of his cyber eyes is just kind of like, all right, okay. And again, we never get get told if it's because he was blind or he just decided to replace them or whatever. But it's perhaps commenting on, you know, even though, you know, that you can blur the lines with this technology and you can abuse it, it can also have positive uses. Because if it was, you know, he lost his eyesight in a battle or he was born blind and now he's got sight, then yeah, great. You know,
knee replacements nowadays, technically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we haven't really talked about it yet, so I'll deal with it now. At the very end, obviously, one of the ultimate conclusions of the film is the merging of the Major and the Puppet Master into a single life form, because it's his version of, like, being alive. The important thing is being able to reproduce and propagate your DNA, and he can't do that. And even though the Major can't, it's kind of, you know, it's taking on a new form and it's evolving both of them beyond, which, again, I don't fully understand. I'm not going to sit and pretend, oh, I totally get what's happening there. Like, I do on a base level, but I don't really understand what it's saying other than, you know, in terms of identity, what's going on there is who's subsuming who and, you know, but, you know, ultimately it's about them going on their adventure now that the previous computer program has a physical form. Excuse me, and the Major has like more understanding of the systems, and so they've both kind of evolved in a way. But I'd be interested in your take on this. Yeah, Sandy, I'll ask you again on what this actually means and what the significance of it was for you.
Because I'm surprised that everybody accepts it so quickly and readily, right? It doesn't take long to convince her to let it, you know, merge with her or let him or her merge with her, and how...
Yeah, pronouns are difficult when you're dealing with things that don't really have...
And how Bateau was just like, this is still my friend and I'm still going to save her and have a conversation. I'm still going to give her the code to my most private safe house, which is oddly 2501 or 2051. So it's just,
is there significance to that? Sorry, because that went over my head there.
It's just that he's project, I'm sorry, what was the number again?
The project number, got you, 2501 or 2051, whatever it was.
Yeah, that was the same as the code to his safe room.
Interesting. That's probably not a coincidence either then. Okay,
but I mean, just the fact that, you know, Batu still accepts this person as more mostly his friend or someone to be trusted. I just, that was hard to accept. But the whole part, I mean, it's just that taking these major philosophical themes, I think that's why I had to watch it four times, and condensing it into an hour and 28 minutes. It just, it's almost like it was just a lesson and less of a story.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have said that some of the more critical things, which I'll get to when we talk about the audience response, a lot of the criticism is, well, it's very much like a philosophy lecture, a dry kind of thing, rather than being, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that criticism, but I also can't fully refute it. Cause like I said, there's an awful lot of, we're just going to stop the action for 10 minutes and have a long speech about the nature of life. But again, that's science fiction cinema sometimes, you know, that's a lot of what it actually does. So I don't mind it so much personally, but I can certainly see why some people would. So, yeah.
And there were certainly moments that it created with the art, the visual and the music together, that were almost separate from that. It's almost like it puts you in a mood while you listen to these things, almost like, you know, an artistic experience or what have you.
Yeah, completely. And again, I'll talk about that when we talk about the music, but it's no coincidence that it uses very specific, like, ancient Japanese vocalizations and things in the soundtrack. Which again, when you're dealing with talking about soul and things, I think that's it's very resonant music to do that rather than using techno or, you know, cold sounding music. Cool. But yeah, I mean, like I said, to try and get into it a little bit with what happened with the Major and the Puppet Master, I found my notes about that. So it is basically just that he says, you know, that the nature of humanity is reproducing and dying, and he can't do either of those things. I use the pronoun he, even though it's genderless because it has a vaguely male-sounding voice. So, yeah, he says, you know, you perpetuate yourself through diversity, and, you know, even though he can't kind of reproduce or whatever, he can evolve to a new level by merging with the Major, and what is left behind is neither the Major or the program, and considers itself a newborn. You know, it even says, where does the newborn go? And it's, again, it's not a coincidence that the film ends with the Bible passage of, you know, when I was a child, I did childish things. Now I've grown beyond that. You know, I've put away childish things or whatever, very paraphrasing, but it's kind of dealing with it that way. And the city itself spread out is like a physical representation of like the net inside of a computer. So it's like, now you're exploring the newest level. You've evolved to the higher plane, as it were. You've transcended human ideas like gender and things like that. And yeah, like I said, the definition there is, if DNA is just like a program, is this life form any more or any less alive or human or sentient than any of us? And where will it go next, I suppose? So yeah, especially considering the Major had the human brain, yeah.
Or is it even more so, more human, because it's more a pure spirit as opposed to including the shell, which experiences, you know, which might be swayed by pleasures or,
yeah,
you know, something like that.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, like I said, the idea of it's still having the Major's kind of human brain or the equivalent sort of thoughts and stuff in there, in mixed in with the kind of program, you know, meaning that it is, you know, presumably more advanced than either one. It's more than the sum of its parts. And like I said, you've got a lot of questions you could say there. Is this the next evolution of what we think of as humanity, or is it just a new species? Is it going to look for its own kind of political asylum, which we deal with in the movie, you know, and have its own rights? Will it look for its own place in the world? And it's a big thing, which I think they don't necessarily pay as much attention to as they should at the end of the movie. Like, it is a really big deal, and it seems like it's kept hush hush, and only really Batu knows about it. And the kind of combined life forms, you know, does a little bit of talking about, you know, its identity, and now we've got a great future ahead of us, and then doesn't really go anywhere. But again, I don't know the sequels. I'm assuming they would deal with some of this, but it's a weird way to kind of end this particular movie. It's interesting the way it deals with a lot of these questions. And like I said, it all comes back to basically needing that diversity in your population. And like I said, the fact that the Major and the Puppet Master together, you know, have evolved into a new life form, the first of its kind. And who knows where that'll go from there, but it'll be interesting to see if I ever do get around to watching those sequels and things.
I feel like I did kind of bash it earlier for being more of a philosophy class, but I just wanted to reiterate, you know, the artistic feel of the movie balancing that.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And yeah, I mean, I've got other notes that I forgot to mention, which is about, you know, they even say really identity is more about how other people treat you than how you see yourself in a lot of ways. You know, we internalize that. And, you know, is a ghost hacked human with no memory or personality, just, you know, just not alive, not sentient? And yeah, what's the other one again? Oh, and then the big question would be, you know, if you can create your body, what's being human about? You know, have you reproduced, or is the fact that it's, you know, there's no human brain there, does it matter, especially if you can have spontaneously sentient programs to fill them, kind of thing? So yeah, lots of big questions, I think. And again, the idea that a ghost is clearly, you know, what they use as a metaphor to, instead of saying soul, you know, and it never really defines what that is, because it can't, and that's between us, I guess. So yeah,
my definition of human is very broad.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's more about, like I said, I mean, what is a soul? Is it a collection of thoughts? Is it something you can't see? Is it emotional connection? Or is it just something we make up to feel better about ourselves, you know? So,
or does it only exist because you have a body?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, can the body and soul exist separately? Once you remove, you know, your soul from your body, is it still there? Is it still quite as, you know, all one piece, or who knows? But anyway, moving on to the acting, I will say that the movie stars the voices of Atsuko Tanaka, Akio Otsuka, and Iyamasa Kayumi, at least if you're watching in the original Japanese. In ordinary anime, characters would at least blink to create the feeling of being animated, but in this movie, interestingly, Motoko's eyes intentionally stayed unblinking many times, which might be what you picked up on about seeming emotionless, Sandy. Yeah, very weird. Director Mamoru Oshii's intention was to portray her as a doll. And I think, yeah, the fact that she looks that way in the end and kind of sounds like the little girl before the voice kind of switches to her old voice as she settles into what looks like the young doll body. Yeah, not a coincidence. And yeah, I have to say, I like a lot of the English dubbing voice actors. As with Akira, I did notice a lot of people who do voice acting in American stuff, particularly Power Rangers actors, because it's very distracting for me as somebody who knows those voices incredibly well. So yeah, any thoughts on the acting, as it were? Because again, it depends on what version you watched. Did you watch the Japanese or the you know, dubbed in whatever accent or whatever language you might want? So yeah, Toby, did you say you watched it in German?
Yeah.
Any comments on the German voice actors that you wanted to leave us with?
I mean, what's great is that they use the same voice actors as in the TV series. So I was like, that's good.
Oh, good.
Consistency.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely, for the most part, yeah. I'm not sure if Motoko is the same voice. It's kind of similar. But for the others,
she changes bodies anyway, so it's kind of, you know, it's fine,
I mean,
I guess the
TV series is kind of a separate thing from the movie. Like,
oh, okay. Got you.
It's the setting and that's it.
And Sandy, you said you watched this entirely all in Japanese, or did one of your four viewings include watching a dubbed version?
And the Japanese audio wasn't available at all on any of the platforms that I looked at. That also included subtitles. Dubbed. Yeah, so it was always dubbed, both versions.
That's fair enough. I think, like I said, I appreciated it a little bit more, which I don't normally always say, but I think I got, because a lot of people would argue, well, you miss a lot of the nuance if you're not watching it in the original language. But I think because of the heavy-handed nature of a lot of the Puppet Master speeches and things, I really kind of only took them in when I heard them in English fully.
One thing that was interesting, it was that in the Ghost in the Shell 2008, there were some errors in the, quite confusing errors in the subtitles.
Oh, really? Oh. Okay.
Yes, even like wrong names being used in place of the correct name. It was really terrible.
So yeah, moving to the direction, I will start by saying it's directed, obviously, the movie, as I said, by Mamoru Oshii. He was assigned to direct the movie, didn't necessarily want to. He was given it, but he later said about the subject matter, "My intuition told me that this story about a futuristic world carried an immediate message for our present world. I'm also interested in computers through my own personal experience with them. I thought it would be interesting to make a film that took place in the near future. There are only a few movies, even out of Hollywood, which clearly portray the influence and power of computers, or at least there was in 1995. I thought this theme would be more effectively conveyed through animation." Oshii expanded on these thoughts in a later interview, noting that technology changes people and had become part of the culture of Japan. He commented that his use of philosophy caused producers to become frustrated because of sparing use of action scenes. And Oshii also acknowledged that a movie with more action would sell better, but he continued to make these movies anyway. When he went back to make changes to the original Ghost in the Shell to re-release it as Ghost in the Shell 2.0, one of the reasons he gave was that the film did not resemble the sequel and he wanted to update the film to reflect changes in perspective. Any idea what that's about, Sandy?
I mean, something I noticed was like in the original animation, like in the very opening sequence when there was some helicopters flying overhead, those were more defined and
yes.
To where you could actually tell that they were helicopters. And like you had mentioned, there was some coloring changes. But overall, the reason I watched it was because of the kind of fuzzier, less defined animation of the earlier version. It did make some subtle plot points a little bit easier to understand, especially some of that. Now, I'm surprised to hear that he toned down the action sequences because I felt there were a lot of action sequences and they were some of the best parts of the movie when there wasn't music. There was sound design directly related to the action sequences that was actually kind of phenomenal. Like when he was running through that those ruins of the old town and his feet slapping the wet, you know, water, you know, there's like a little bit of water above the pavement. That noise when they were going through the crowded shopping market section, how some voices were nearer, some voices were further away. I thought all the action sequences, you know, because of that, were actually really, really well done.
Yeah, I mean, there are action sequences in the film, but it's just that when you look at Japanese anime as a whole, you generally expect like wall-to-wall action. And I said a lot of this kind of stops to to give you speeches and to philosophize, exactly. You know, and you know, that's fair enough. It's got a lot of things to get across, like I said, and whether you think it's successful or not is a, you know, it's a matter of personal taste, I guess. But yeah, that's fair enough. I'll be honest as well. First of all, I have to stick up for the animation because I have to say, having watched it on 4K, it did not seem blurry and outdated, even in the 1995 version. It was fantastic. But I also thought, to the specific point you mentioned about the helicopters, I thought that they were deliberately kind of vague because I always thought of them as kind of a metaphor for, they look almost like angels coming down, just as kind of we're dealing with the death and rebirth of the Major. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that's a deliberate choice, but maybe it wasn't, and it was just, you know, the animation wasn't up to do portraying helicopters, but I certainly took some meaning in that, whether it was there or not. Oshii was so obsessed with realistic movement in every frame, especially the shooting scenes, that he took the production to Guam to shoot guns into different materials and see how they reacted. And it's one of his director trademarks, is the usage of guns, and the character of Tagusa preferring to use a revolver over a semi-automatic pistol, which was a nice little subplot that I enjoyed, that he uses the, you know, the old-fashioned gun, and he gets a lot of flak for it and uses it to plant the tracker. And then the guy's like, well, if you'd use one of our weapons, you'd have been able to plant like six trackers, but whatever, good job. So, yeah, pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, I like that the creation of the cyborgs to me was very reminiscent of Westworld. It kind of had that vibe. It didn't just feel like, you know, blank robots and stuff. Love the use of light and the way the city looks. Again, the actual cityscapes were something that was a point of pride, I think, in the animation. Yeah, the POV shots and the first person shots, which you always get when you're dealing with robots and that kind of thing. And it also helps you to deal with the identity and those issues. Yeah, and the one thing that I always am amazed by is the mad typing fingers of the kind of the cyborg receptionist or whatever, where it just extends into these things that can,
especially when they made it sound like Section 6 didn't have any cybernetics in it, and then all of a sudden, and of course we find out later he's an American neuroscientist or what have you.
Yeah, completely. And I love that discussion as well, when they actually have that little debate about, well, do you trust the neurosurgeons that muck around in your brain? And he says, well, you know, these people have to be vetted, and you know, they've got to be analyzed, and we have to make sure they're up to the task. But then again, the people that are analyzing them are also only human, so you'd be on forever feeling like thinking like that, and you could drive yourself mad. But we just have to take it on faith, I guess. So interesting way of looking at that. And what was I going to say? Yeah, and I love, again, dealing with the kind of almost post-gender nature of the Major, the way that when she is trying to rip into the tank at the end, her muscles like start bulging and she literally just rips her body apart, which is just one of the most bizarre and yet awesome visuals that I've seen. When I was like, wow, she really does just tear that shell completely to bits in the effort of trying to pull open this thing.
He told her without fail. And she took that literally.
Well, very literally. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, but it's such a good scene. I do like that. As he said, the action scenes are great, including that one as well. The fight between the Major and the tank, I think, is awesome. The big spider tank.
That was definitely the most disturbing visual to me, just seeing her, because we did get to know her now and at least respect her. And then just to see her body being shaken around and lifeless, it was a bit upsetting.
And on the table, kind of almost in pieces next to the Puppet Master's shell, you know, them lying and communicating with each other, and Batu clearly being a bit disturbed by that as well. It was a bit odd. So, yeah, fair enough. Any thoughts then on the rest of the direction or anything?
Just thinking in retrospect about when the body first left the factory and got run over by the car, how she turned around and was looking at the car. It kind of only just occurred to me during our discussion that was because she was trying to possibly experience death, because that was in her or his its belief system, that experiencing death was part of being alive, or at least being human.
Mortality is eerie. Comes up a lot.
I mean, there are some like 4 minutes compilations of just shots and ambience. It was a bit much, I would say.
Oh, I love it. I love it because I love the animation style and I think it really works. And I should have mentioned as well, sorry, go ahead.
I think what is on the picture is a little bit, like, not enough for 4 minutes, I'd say. Let's just say that. Like,
But it's a very ponderous film at times, yeah.
Goes on, it's a lot.
I don't mind it, like I said, because I admire the visuals and the way the cityscape looks and stuff anyway. And as I was going to say, I just love the thermoptic camouflage. I just think it's such a cool little visual of an idea as well. And again, you got to remember it's 1995. That kind of thing would not have been easy to animate, but I think it looks really cool, which is why it's my little avatar here, the major in the camouflage. So yeah, the way it kind of, you know, it starts and it's visibly there and then it fades more and more and just becomes camouflage to the background, chameleon-like. It's brilliant, I think. So, yeah, I'm going to move to the VFX production design then, just to move us along, and say that the film's visuals were created actually with a combination of traditional cell animation and CGI animation. Hiroyuki Okiura, character designer and key animation supervisor, designed Motoko to be more mature and serious, choosing to depict a physically mature person to match Motoko's mental age instead of her youthful 20-something appearance from the manga. Motoko's demeanor lacks the comedic facial expressions and rebellious nature depicted in the manga, instead taking on a more wistful and contemplative personality, which I think is interesting. Oshii based the setting for Ghost in the Shell on Hong Kong, saying that Hong Kong was the perfect subject and theme for the film with its countless signs and cacophony of sounds. And the film's mecha designer, Takeuchi Atsushi, noted that while the film does not have a chosen setting, it's obviously based on Hong Kong because the city represented the theme of the film, the old and the new, which exist in a strange relationship in an age of information deluge. Before shooting the film, the artists drew sketches that emphasized Hong Kong's chaotic, confusing, and overwhelming aspects. And I just noted a lot of kind of real dedication, like even the, you know, people's reflections in windows get animated and stuff. So there's a lot of, like we kind of dealt with when we're talking about Akira and the way it would animate things like lens flares and stuff. There's a lot of very specific animation that I really love, where effort must have went into it. Did anything stand out to you, Toby?
Not really any specific shot or anything. I personally just really like this kind of older anime style, of that. That's just really cool, and obviously this is done in a lot more high quality fashion than a lot of other older animation of like TV series or smaller movies or something. This is really well crafted, but I just really love this style in general.
Yeah, fair enough. Cool. And what about you, Sandy? Any thoughts on the kind of the animation and overall looks?
Personally less like this style, but there was still obviously a lot to appreciate. Some of the things that they did with Kasanagi's eyes, for example, the crystal blue, it actually reminded me of like Attack on Titan. I realize it's referencing the other way around, since Attack on Titan came later, but just like the crystal blue eyes and how full of life they look. I think that's hard to achieve. And like I mentioned, cybernetic body is after it had escaped the factory, just had a look in her eyes that was full of life and kind of wanting to experience death was interesting. As Mike mentioned, the city, especially in the beginning when she first wakes up and the window is just framing the city outside as she moves around the apartment and leaves. That's, you know, pretty cool. Probably my favorite sequence though, and because it was set to the music, and I know we haven't got to that, you know, we just touched on that, was that opening sequence with the building of the body. I just thought that was really haunting and visually very appealing. And then how they, you know, just how they work on the representations of the real world in a with a cyber sense, like the grid overlay, and her being able to zone in and listen into a conversation happening downstairs in the building. I thought those were all very interesting choices, and it was very, very much world building. All of the visuals, more so than any of the philosophy or anything, where the visuals were the world building.
Yeah. Okay. True. Fair enough. Fair enough. Awesome. So, yeah, I think we've all basically given a lot of good praise to the animation, apart from whether it's your style or not. I think you can appreciate the work that went into it. So, yeah, I'm going to move to the music and sound, unless anybody wants to chime in with anything else. And I will say, Ghost in the Shell's recording was done with a high-end studio to achieve superior sound throughout the film. A spatializer was used to alter the sound, specifically in the electronic brain conversations, to modify the voices. Composer Kenji Kawai scored the film. For the main theme, he tried to imagine the setting and convey the essence of that world. He used classical Japanese in the opening theme, Making of a Cyborg. The composition is a mixture of Bulgarian harmony and traditional Japanese notes. The haunting chorals are actually a wedding song that is sung to dispel evil influences. Symphony conductor Sarah Penica-Smith notes that the song's lyrics are fitting for the union between Kusanagi and Project 2501 at the climax of the movie. Kawai originally wanted to use Bulgarian folk music singers, but used Japanese folk singers instead. See You Every Day is different from the rest of the soundtrack, being a pop song that is sung in Cantonese by Fang Kao Wing. And the end credits theme of the film's English version is 1 Minute Warning by Passengers, which is a collaboration between U2 and Brian Eno. They got the gig because apparently one of the people that works for Manga is also U2's manager. So that's how they got that. So, yeah. So any thoughts on the music and the kind of effect that they've had on you when you watched the film?
I really liked that haunting melody a lot. And it did stick in my mind afterwards, but it was definitely a mood setting tone, and it wouldn't be the same without it. It was integral to this, like sound, like music is for a lot of visual medium, but yeah. Just really, really liked it in this.
Yeah, fair enough. And what about you, Toby? Did the music hit you in any way?
There is, I don't know where exactly because I forgot. There is a track, it's somewhere in the back half and like one of those action kind of scenes. Where there is not the voice, but there is like a synth track, really jarring synth. That's really creepy. That's really cool.
Oh right, yeah, okay. Fair enough. Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of thing. So yeah, okay. Yeah, I think, like I said, I kind of see the, because it's quite haunting music, or that's what I would call it, I kind of see it as very representative of the, you know, questioning the nature of a soul and stuff. So I think it works really well. Plus, obviously, the more machine-based aspects when you get into the thing you were talking about, Toby, as well. So, yeah, okay. But yeah, I think it's very good. And as you said, in terms of the sound design, Sandy, I think it also, it gets effective when it doesn't have music and it's relying entirely on sound design and little sounds and action beats and things. So yeah, definitely agree with you on that one. I'm going to move us on then, because we've talked a little bit about the music and the effect it had, to the audience response to this. As always, I did put out a prompt on social media asking what people thought of Ghost in the Shell. A fair response, so I'm just going to jump in and read that out now. First of all, from various Facebook groups, starting with the golden age of anime, 70s, 80s and 90s, Ian Foster says, "So nice, I got it twice," and has copies of it on DVD twice by the looks of it in the picture here. John Mojal says, "Would even give it a 10 out of 5 rating. Ryan Sorensen says it's one of the all-time greats. Kevin Mora says, "The more I watch it, the more I like it." Daniel Sly says, "I really enjoyed it. I still think it holds up to date. Saw it 3 or 4 times at the local art house theatre when it came out back in the 1990s. If I have any issue with it, it's that I had read the manga before seeing the film and judged it against that. Visually and narratively, the styles are quite different." Richard Lanes says, "The creator loves San Miguel beer." Yes, I did notice a lot of the product placement in there. Craig Carroll says it's S tier. Loki Bottleoff says, "I love it. One of my favorite anime." And David Zam has just put a picture of the standalone complex original soundtrack. Clearly a fan of that. Cameron Cooper says, fantastic anime. I loved the first two films. The franchise does suffer a bit with sounding like the ramblings of a second-year philosophy student, though. So, yeah, fair enough. Over on Blue Sky, the Diva Santanica says, one of my top five movies ever. I watch it, its sequels, and the standalone complex series when I have time. I still have my VHS copies of dubbed and subbed versions of the movie. The existence of the live-action version, however, .. Yeah, fair enough. Over on Facebook's action and sci-fi movies of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, James Gordon, I assume not, you know, the commissioner, says, I enjoyed the first half of the film. However, towards the ending, it just wraps up and leaves a bunch of unanswered questions. It also annoys me they never made a true sequel to this film, as I love the setting of it along with its characters. I felt the film was better than the manga it was based on, as it was more comedic than serious, meaning the manga was more comedic. Yeah, and I think that was all I had from the audience. So, I mean, mostly positive, slightly mixed, perhaps. So are you guys ready to move to we'll give our favourite character moment in line then, as I always do. I know, as I said, DK doesn't do this on Cult Classics, but I like to do it on mine just to give us a, you know, an indication how the film hit us. So I'm going to go around and ask first for your favourite character in the movie and why. And Toby, I'll start with you.
Favourite character? I'm kind of torn between two.
Okay.
I think the best character in the movie is Motoko. But the character I like the most, but doesn't get a lot of screen time, so I can't really say that, is Togusa. Because I really like his that his perspective is thrown in, but not a lot, which I think is kind of a shame. I think we could use more of him, because I think we kind of need that perspective. Like, even though it's not my perspective, personally, like, I would jump into cybernetics immediately. Not by Elon Musk, please. Not by Elon Musk. God, not...
What about you then, Sandy? Who was your favorite character in Black?
My favorite character was actually Ishikawa, because he's the one that, like, put everything together. He's like just this old grizzled guy in the background who, again, doesn't have much screen time, but is surprisingly relevant, because you know, he's the one that's like, you know, try this one on for size, you know, this is what if he's the tool, what if they're actually trying to recover him, not capture him, and you know, stuff like that. I just, and then just his whole aesthetic of just like, you know, just sitting in here with his arms behind his head, just kicking back. Yeah, I was in here digging around all their files and stuff. And I just wish there was more of him. So he quickly became my favorite character.
Okay, cool. So it's kind of becoming a running theme. We want more of the characters we like. I have similar thoughts as well. I think I wanted to pick the Major, and I was very close to picking it, because it's obvious that she is the main character. But I do find her kind of constant kind of questioning of her identity and the way that she's not human entirely to be a little bit difficult to connect with for me. So my favorite character that I actually went with was Batu. I like his loyalty and his protectiveness, plus his lack of kind of ulterior motives like that everybody else seems to have. And again, I would have liked to see more of him and see, you know, how he operates with others as well as Kusanagi. So yeah, I'm gonna go with Batu, and then thus none of us have actually picked the main character, which is ironic, but she was close with me, obviously.
For everyone wanting more of specific characters, there's a 52 piece television show to watch. Plugging it again.
well played, well done. Fair enough. So, the next one then would be, what was your favorite moment or scene, whether you want to define that? And Toby, I'll come to you again.
Oh no, please don't come to me again. First, wait a minute. I thought of something a minute ago, and then now it's just slipped my mind again. Oh yeah, nope. I have it now again. I mean, it's not really a moment, a sequence of moments, and what I think personally is maybe not the most interesting part of the movie, but the most connected to part of the movie is this whole sequence of when they chase the garbage man with the memories, and how that all unfolds until we find out everything. It's like a 10-minute sequence.
It is, but that's, I mean, that's a fair point, and it's a good action scene as well. If you're,
it's a good action scene, it has a lot of, but still has a really interesting point, idea, and it shows us the repercussions of that. It's not to plug again, but it's the moment I think reminds me most of the TV series.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, that's cool. I mean, like I said, that as much as people criticize it, I think there is action in this. That's, you know, there's a lot of it to like, and that would certainly be one of them.
Yeah,
what about you, Sandy?
I think the problem with the action is what I think would be a valid criticism, is that it's a little not greatly paced. There's a lot of the action, there's a lot of action in the first half, and it just, there's nothing of action in the second half, but I think the action becomes a little less interesting in the second half. So I think that's fair that you get a little bored by that. I think
Okay, fair enough.
I disagree with that, but I can totally see how you get bored by that.
You might think that, yeah. Okay, fair enough. We'll move on then to Sandy for your favorite scene or moment or something that you want to shout out in the film.
My favorite scene or moment, and the one that I found myself really more engrossed in, was just that. I mentioned it before, that opening sequence where the body is being built with, along with the sound from the theme music. It was just very haunting and ethereal, and again, very tone setting. And I just really became engrossed every time that part came on.
That was the stuff that reminded me a lot of Westworld. The way that they create their hosts, and they do something very similar. But yeah, it's a great sequence. My scene, I was going to say, I actually want to shout out, first of all, to kind of to push back a little bit about the lack of action in the latter half of the film. I actually think if I was going to pick action, my action scene would have been the fight between Major and the big spider tank at the end of the movie, because I think that's actually a fantastic action beat. But if I'm honest with myself, my actual favorite moments are the two Puppet Master speeches, even though, like I said, they're probably what put a lot of people off. I really just dug them. So yeah, that's what I would go with. So yeah, do you have a favorite quote, Toby? You knew it was coming, so have you thought of one?
I don't have a favorite quote. I'm just going to skip this question.
Okay, fair enough. You're allowed. I'll allow it in this instance. So what about you, Sandy? Do you have a favorite quote that comes to mind?
I think just the more thought-provoking question when Project 2501 was trying to get, was arguing for his right to claim, the word escapes me,
sentience or life.
When he was trying to get diplomatic immunity, what was the word?
Asylum.
There we go. When he was trying to claim asylum and talking about life, and he said, and can you offer me proof of your existence? How can you, when neither modern science nor philosophy can explain what life is? And I thought that was kind of the whole question and the whole point of the anime. Yeah, and so that one just kind of stood out to me.
Awesome. I picked exactly the same thing, so I don't need to go over it again because you just gave it. So that was also mine as well. There's a lot of great quotes in here, though, as I said, but we'd be on forever if I was just reciting the various speeches that the Puppet Master gives. But yeah, I did like that as being a quite a clever little summation of the movie in a nutshell. So yeah, all that remains then is to give our conclusions and score out of 5 stars, as we always do. So again, we'll start with you, Toby. Do you have a conclusion and score for us?
Honestly, I don't have a score yet, so I'm just going to say a few things and hopefully pick off a score at the end.
Okay. Well, that's all right. Come to your conclusion yourself. That's fine.
I mean, okay. I think the first barrier I needed to jump over was the difference to the television. I'm going to keep plugging it in. It's going to keep happening.
That's fine. That's what you know.
Such a different approach. In the sense that it's just, I mean, there are no speeches in the television series. Nobody's like giving you a lecture. It's a lot more showing ethical dilemmas versus explaining them. And this is more an explanation and not at least when we talk about the Puppet Master, there's not a lot shown about him, like the difficulties of him, what he represents, what how he feels, I guess. Like there isn't really a lot shown. It's all very theoretical, and I think you need to, I need it at least, to kind of get over that a little, to appreciate this movie more. And I think doing this podcast, that's really where it happened. I think I went into this a lot more negative about this movie than I now come out of, because now I have the possibility to talk about these things that through discussing these various philosophical things that are in this movie, you can appreciate this movie more. And I think that's kind of a step you need to do to really appreciate this movie more. And I think a lot of people that maybe don't appreciate this movie as much watch it and don't really think about it further. So I think I came out liking this movie a lot more after this podcast and really appreciating the things it's doing. I still think it's a really difficult movie to watch. And I think when I see people say like, oh, this is like a must-watch movie, I'm like, I don't know. Like, this is difficult.
Yeah.
Like when I think about, oh, like sci-fi movies you have to watch, I would think of something that's a little more digestible. Like, it makes what it says clear, but it's doing it in a way that's just not as accessible for most people.
The guy in the criticism part said the same thing. It comes off a lot like a philosophy lecture in places, which can be very off-putting, you know.
So. Yeah, and I think you really need to be either really into this or take the step to get into this.
Yeah.
To really appreciate it. And I think if you're just watching it as like, oh, I'm just watching a cute movie this night, man, you're not going to get that much enjoyment out of it.
You've got to be in the mood, yeah. You can't just expect, oh, I'll have it on in the background as a bit of action or whatever, and because it's not going to really go in. I think in that case, is it? So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's less of a mood issue and more of a intention issue. Like, I think you need to go into this movie with the intention of, okay, this is something deeper. I need to think. I need to maybe talk about it with people. I think if you're just going with the intention of, oh, I'm just going to enjoy this as, quote unquote, a movie, I think you're most likely going to have not a bad time. I think it still has a lot of cool stuff, cool action scenes, nice characters. So it's not like you don't get anything. But I think your enjoyment is lessened by that a lot.
Mm. Okay. So has that helped you to clarify a number then for the year?
I just kind of gravitate to my standard number. I give way too many movies. Oh, no, wait, we're doing out of five. Let me convert. 3.5. Thank you.
3.5? That's basically what I more or less expected. I'll be honest, like I said, it took me three watches to fully understand it. And the very first time I watched this, like I said, it kind of washed over me and I was like, oh, I don't really get it. And I didn't understand that you had to, you know, lock in and really engage with the movie and, you know, engage outside of watching the movie as well with a lot of what it's asking you. So I think that's basically what you were saying. Yeah, fair enough. So what about you, Sandy? Do you have your conclusion and your score out of five?
I really felt, again, much like you, like the first time I ran through the movie, I was just trying to understand what was happening and taking some things we found out later and applying them to the beginning to help some of those things make more sense. So as a film, we're just thrown into the subject matter. And I do wonder how much is lost in translation, that if in the Japanese original language version, that the way, you know, they have words with certain connotations and maybe in the translation, some of that was missed, which would have made it more clear. But as I saw it, I didn't appreciate that it was so confusing and that, you know, I had to really stop and think and even read about what was going on. Just things, you know, I don't like it when films pander to you alternatively, but In this sense, yeah, it was just very confusing. We're thrown into this world without a lot of context, but there was a lot of exposition later on things that, you know, were actually becoming more obvious to us without it. So, you know, as a film, I think its merits are with the animation, with the sound design, even in the dubbed version, and in bringing these philosophical ideas to a wider audience. But I feel like everything that was inspired by this film took each of those ideas and did them with a better story and something that appealed to me personally more. This film, this just didn't feel complete as it was presented, though it certainly had some great elements. And because of that, I also gave it 3.5.
Okay, fair enough. I'm going to give you my conclusion then. And again, I always say apologies for it being quite long, but just it's my opportunity to indulge my desire to be a film journalist, so just bear with my long-ass conclusion. I just said, it's hard to believe that this film is now 30 years old. You can see why it was so influential. It was ahead of its time in exploring technology, the blurred lines between computers and humanity, and the philosophical questions around the nature of life. Can a cyber brain create a soul? But beyond that, the film's deeper themes of identity and search for meaning are timeless, and they likely always will be. What makes Ghost in the Shell stand out is how it delivers these ideas in such a succinct package. The animation is stunning, the concepts and action are thrilling, and it never talks down to its audience, which for me makes it a real masterpiece. That said, I have to acknowledge some flaws. There are moments where the animation takes shortcuts, such as psychic communication or shots filmed from behind to avoid animating moving lips, which are noticeable if you're familiar with the process. The pacing is also incredibly fast, which can make it difficult to absorb everything. And at just under 80 minutes, it feels too short. But honestly, the fact that I wanted more is more of a compliment than a criticism. The only real downside is that the philosophical musings, as I've said, can feel heavy-handed, which might disengage some viewers. But all that aside, I absolutely love this film. The sci-fi nerd in me is always drawn to stories about robots and cyborgs questioning their sentience. Maybe that's why I love Data in Star Trek so much. Ghost in the Shell made people think, played a major role in legitimizing anime, and shaped the sci-fi landscape that we have today. It's intelligent, mature, and thought-provoking, and it has a kick-ass cyborg lady taking down a tank. What more could you want? And I actually give it 4.5 out of 5. Not surprising, I thought I would probably end up being the highest score. So, yeah, putting those together, dividing by 3 to give us our final score then. The conclusion is that Ghost in the Shell comes with a score of 3.8 out of 5, which not too bad, I think. We're almost at 4 out of 5. So, yeah, you guys happy with that?
Yes.
Sure.
Cool.
I don't think others will be.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's our podcast, but yeah, it depends on who you talk to about this film. It's one of the things that I think it means different things to different people, and it'll be interesting. It's interesting to discuss, honestly, just, you know, among people that have seen the movie. And again, it gives you a new perspective, as Toby was saying, as you discuss it. And there might be things you've missed. I know there certainly were things I did the first couple of times. So yeah, fair enough. All right then, folks, I think we've successfully avoided being hacked, ghost hijacked, or recruited into a shadowy government conspiracy. So that about wraps up our deep dive into Ghost in the Shell. A huge thank you to my incredible guests for helping me navigate this cyberpunk labyrinth. Toby and Sandy, you've both been fantastic. Before we jack out of the system, could you let the people know where they can find you online, starting with you, Toby?
As always, on Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, which is Dark Sonic, yeah?
Yeah. Can awesome. I plug one thing?
Go for it, yeah.
It's not where do you find it. I just want to plug another TV series.
Okay.
I think people that enjoyed this movie might also enjoy the TV series The Gene of AI. It's also an anime series.
Which okay.
It's 12 episodes, not that long.
And Sandy, are you still basically avoiding the absolute nightmare that is social media?
Yeah, I'm distancing myself for the eventual AI takeover, so I'll be one of the last ones to go.
I've just been making friends with it, to be perfectly honest. Given how bad some of the humans in charge are, they couldn't really do much worse. Anyway, so as always, if you want to keep up with the Silver Screen podcast, all of our links, socials, Discord, ways to support us are in the link tree, which you can always find in the episode description and flashing up on screen right now if you're watching on YouTube. No need to scan for a hidden data node, we make it easy. Now, if you're hungry for more pop culture discussions, you won't have to wait long. In just 3 days, our sister podcast, Hit or Miss Hugh Trek, is back with a full review of Star Trek Section 31. we'll break down Michelle Yeoh's return as the galaxy's most ruthless emperor's turned spy, and knowing us, probably make at least three jokes about time travel paradoxes. And right after that, DK is back at the helm for Cult Classics, this time taking a dimension-hopping journey into Twilight Zone, the movie. We'll be talking eerie stories, tragic behind-the-scenes chaos, and whether Lithgow or Shatner gave the best Gremlin on the Wing performance. So be sure to subscribe, hit that notification bell, or implant a cybernetic reminder chip. Whatever works for you. So yeah, thanks again for tuning in, and until next time, remember, your body might be meat and circuits, but cinema is eternal. See you soon.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Mike Wilson. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. Link to all of these places can be found via the link tree listed in this episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production, created, produced, and edited by Mike Wilson. We'd love it if you'd like, subscribe, and share us around like a beloved old video cassette. We hope to see you next time for more movie magic. Until then, remember, life moves pretty fast, so stop and watch a movie now and then.